Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. My name is Rahul Brown, and I'm delighted to be hosting our global weekly Awaken Call. Today, we are fortunate to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Lee Perlman. This week's theme is Love and Philosophy Between Prison Walls and Ivory Towers, which to me is really about the process and skill of stepping into a radically different frame of reference so that that shift can catalyze remarkable learning and learning moments for all. We have the great pleasure of having Preeta Bansal as our moderator today.
Thanks, Rahul. I'm really pleased to be here in conversation with Lee today. I think the work he's doing is just so tremendous and remarkable. As you said, the ability to radically step into a different environment and be open and curious to the learnings that we receive from that. He's a teacher, but he's deeply curious and committed to learning and bridging so many of these social divides that appear in our external systems and to find the commonality within that underlies all those. So I'm very excited to be in conversation with him. Lee Perlman is a lecturer at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's a lecturer in philosophy. He's been there for almost 35 years now, teaching in this remarkable little group called the Experimental Study Group, which is MIT's first freshman learning community. It was a community that was founded in 1969, and it offers a tight-knit intellectual community that is about innovation and creativity in the educational process. And Lee has taken this this Experimental Study Group one step further by founding the MIT Prison Initiative. And in that, he teaches classes to a mixed cohort of MIT students and prisoners at two medium to maximum security correctional institutions in Massachusetts, which are in Norfolk and Framingham. He travels with MIT students each week by van to these correctional institutions to engage in discussion and study with the imprisoned fellow students, many of whom are incarcerated for life. And remarkably, the courses he teaches are just so deep and intellectually rich, as well as spiritually rich. The courses include self and soul, philosophy of love, and nonviolence as a way of life. And I've actually glanced at some of his syllabi, and they are just breathtaking. And certainly not light in any way, deep readings and deep and rich themes. So, you know, Lee, we're just incredibly excited to have you. And I'll just add by way of introduction as well that Dr. Perlman, in addition to having an illustrious career in academia, has a pretty remarkable background in policy and politics. He was involved in Baltimore and in Maryland for a number of years as a political organizer, including serving as the executive director of Common Cause in Maryland. And in 1978, Baltimore Magazine named him the most feared lobbyist in Maryland. So with that, welcome, and thank you for being here with us.
Thank you. I'm excited for this conversation. Thank you, Preeta.
Great. So I thought maybe we could just start at the very beginning. Tell us a little bit about your story, kind of how you grew up, where you grew up, and, you know, how you got interested in philosophy and politics.
Well, I grew up outside of New York and outside of Detroit, and I grew up in a pretty political family, my family was actually pretty chaotic, and I think that has something to do with my bent towards philosophy that I've had the what's this all about question in my mind since I was little. I was always very intellectually curious, but I was, for the most part, not a very good student because I hated school. And in fact, when I was a junior in high school. In the middle of the night, one night, I got on a bus and just left town. I called my parents. I traveled hundreds of miles to another city, and a couple weeks later talked to my parents and told them I would only come home if they would send me away to boarding school. And they agreed, and I spent a year in boarding school, and that was a year that really turned my life around because I became a kind of monk of knowledge. I'd always read a lot, but I just, for the first time, really disciplined myself and just fell in love with learning. That's I think, the background of my philosophical interests. Although it took me a really long time to actually settle in and to being a philosopher in the sense of devoting my life to learning.
Interesting. So just I have to ask a little bit more about that. That was too intriguing. So what, you're a junior, I think you said, in high school, and you took a bus, and then you said you wanted to go to, you would only come back if you could go to boarding school. Can you just tell us a little bit about that? Like, what, did you have a particular boarding school in mind, and why, and what was your frustration with your current educational environment?
I hated school, and I was completely confused about why, because I read all the time. One anecdote was before I took the bus out of town, I got a report card, and I failed every subject in high school. And one of my classes I failed was my history class, and one anecdote about that is I piled up a bunch of books in front of me, and the teacher snuck around behind me, clearly suspicious I was up to no good. And behind all those books, instead of paying attention in class, I was reading War and Peace. And he gave me the most curious look, like he didn't know what to do with that. So there was some part of me that I could only do the things I wasn't supposed to be doing, but I read really serious stuff. I just needed to figure myself out. And whatever it was in my home life, I couldn't fix it while I was at home. So I had the insight that I needed to go somewhere. It was back in the 60s. I needed to go somewhere where they kind of shaved my head and put me in a suit and you know, lock me away so I could do nothing but study.
Wow. Awesome. That's amazing. And you mentioned you had kind of you grew up in a political family. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. And also, did you have any spiritual upbringing?
I had an anti-spiritual upbringing. My parents were both atheists and thought of anything smacking of spirituality as pure mumbo-jumbo. They both had a left-leaning politics. My mother was very involved in civil rights in Michigan. She was involved especially around Pontiac with a group that worked for fair housing and things like that. In fact, when my parents moved away from Michigan before I was finished with high school, I wound up going up to Pontiac to stay with some of the African-American folks that my mother was working with. I wound up living for a while in a halfway house for delinquent girls. So, yeah, there was always politics in my house. And there was no spirituality whatsoever. My parents, I think, actually saw that as those two things as completely antithetical. Spiritual people were people that were sort of not involved in the world.
Interesting. So then after high school, you went off to St. John's College, which I know as principally the Great Book School. I don't know if it was still that back then, or I'm just curious, how did you make that decision? Was the kind of reading a big part of that that drew you to there?
Life's a funny thing. It just sort of sometimes bounces you around until you find yourself in the right place. I started off actually at Kalamazoo College in Michigan because I wanted to stay in Michigan. because my friends were there and my girlfriend was there. And I just, it was a good school, but it was a typical cafeteria-style school where you just sort of picked and chose things. And I had no idea what I was doing or why. And then one day I was visiting a friend of mine on the East Coast, and we actually went to see the movie Yellow Submarine. I bumped into this guy who had gone to St. John's, and as soon as I heard about it, I just knew this was the place I had to be. It was thing about St. John's is you start at the beginning. It's all Western philosophy, but you start at the beginning with the Greeks, and you spend 4 years just going through everything, every great work in every discipline that's ever been written, and that I just needed to start at the beginning. I think that's the main thing. I need to start at the beginning and work my way through how this civilization, at least, has thought through the same problems over and over again from different perspectives. And really, intellectually, that set the whole course of my life. That's the kind of stuff I've been doing ever since.
That's amazing. It's beautiful. So at some point in your education, like maybe after college or grad school, you went into politics and policy. Can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of tell us what led you to that, and then eventually what led you back to the ivory tower after your experience in the political and policy world?
So I think St. John's College is in Annapolis, Maryland, which is the capital of the state of Maryland. And I think my geographical situation captured a kind of split in my soul, because St. John's is almost like a monastery of learning. It's a very deeply impractical place in a certain way. You just think about deep things for 4 years. You get out. People go on to regular careers afterwards, but you get out of there not prepared for any particular career. So that's the part of my soul that just wants to contemplate. And then there's this other part of my soul that wants to do and make a difference in the world. So St. John's, this little monastery of learning, is a block away from the state capitol in Maryland. And I began back then my ping-ponging between the two poles of my soul. Even while I was in college, I started to get involved a little bit in politics. And when I got out, it was just very natural, given that I had such a political background in my family, for me to start lobbying at the state legislature. I soon became the, I was good at it, I found. I really could click in from this very sort of contemplative personality. I could really turn a switch and become a kind of a kick-ass lobbyist, and I was pretty hardcore, and as you said earlier, I was named most feared lobbyist in Maryland. And after Common Cause, I started with a couple of other guys I knew who were public interest lobbyists. We started our own firm, and we lobbied for environmental issues and tenants' rights and a whole bunch of things. And so I was fully immersed in the active political life in Maryland. And then you asked, how did I get back into the ivory tower? There was something, I was happy with what I was doing. I was going places. I was getting into lists of, you know, in the Baltimore Sun, I was in a list of most promising political figures in Maryland. I ran for the state Senate, and I almost won when I was still in my 20s. But something, that other part of my soul wasn't being fed. So I thought to myself, I'll find a compromise route. And I actually went back to grad school in political science, which is what got me up to MIT. I went to MIT and got my PhD in political science, thinking that would be a compromise between the contemplative and the active. But I found it was actually sort of neither. Rather than both, it was sort of neither. I neither could get to the depth of thinking I wanted to, nor was I actually getting anything done in the world. So while I was in grad school, I floated back into full throttle philosophy. My thesis advisor had a joint appointment in philosophy and political science. I went out, spent some years teaching in political science departments around the country, and then came back to the experimental study group at MIT, where I had complete freedom to reinvent myself, and reinvented myself as just a complete philosopher. And since then, it's been great. I just teach what I want, and when I want to learn things, I formulate a course so I can spend some time thinking about them. But then I spent a long period of time really just completely immersed in the contemplative side, and it's only recently that I've gotten back into the active side, and I'm trying a new form of synthesis of those two. So I have a lot to say about that when we get to that point in the conversation.
Great. Wow, that's so amazing. Such a great set of experiences. I'm curious, when you were in Maryland doing the lobbying, you mentioned that you were, obviously you were named one of the most feared lobbyists. Why do you think that is? What was fearful to others about what you were doing?
Well, I was not just one of the most feared lobbyists. I was the most feared lobbyyist. This was in Baltimore Magazine, and what they said about it was I was feared for making legislators do the things they didn't want to do. The legislators named me, and I started being called in the newspapers. They named me the Wolfman. And there's a cartoon in one Baltimore magazine I still have of me up in the gallery in the legislature, looking like a Wolfman with the full moon coming out and ready to pounce on the legislators. I mean, legislators are very, I always thought of them as kind of like billiard balls as the least free people around. Whatever's the strongest force, they have to go in that direction. So I just learned how to pull those levers of power. I had situations where, I had one situation now where a legislator, I put such pressure on this legislator. He was the last vote we needed in a committee to get campaign financing bill out, and he had such pressure on him that he kind of like cracked, and at one point threw me against a wall and cocked his fist about as if he was about to punch me, and then he went in and he voted with us, and the bill came out of committee. It was that kind of a pressure cooker environment, and part of me loved it. It was really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you make that sound kind of simple, the exerting the levers of power in that way to get people to do what you want, but that's not an easy thing. And I'm just curious, what was the skill? Like, how were you able to do that? How were you able to get people to do what you needed?
I want to get back, when we get back into how I'm synthesizing it now, I want to say more about this, but even back then, it was a combination. It was a combination of skills that I think I had by nature, and one of them is that I'm actually just a pretty friendly person, and I actually really like people. And some of the people that had come before me had. Who had done this kind of work had just been so dismissive of the legislators, but I actually liked them and I actually hung out with them, and I went to the bars at night where they went, and I just, outside of the work, they had a sense of me that I was like an okay guy. But at the same time, I had a large organization. Common Cause at the time had 12,000 members, so we were very well organized. We can get the pressure on really quickly. I also discovered I used to do things like, I mean, here's one technique I would use when our campaign financing bill was in trouble. I looked at the list of donors of some of the people that were on the fence, and I just called them. I found like people like a president of a bank who was in the district of the guy that we were trying to move, and I called them one-on-one and asked them and tried to convince them of our issue. And sometimes those guys would then call up. They were it's sort of like leaving no stone unturned as part of the process.
Wow. So as you were doing all this, you mentioned that, you know, a part of your soul was not being fed, the more monastic, contemplative side. Were you kind of doing full-on lobbying, or were you able to keep up your reading and your kind of intellectual search during that time?
It was both. I mean, you know, here's a funny story. There was one point I was, I did go start taking philosophy classes at night and at Catholic University, which was an hour away from Annapolis. And I remember one day I spent doing the kinds of things I just described. I mean, I'd do things like I'd sit in the gallery and watch the vote tally on the board, see who wasn't there, and then I'd run like into the bathroom and I'd find legislators hiding in the bathroom who didn't want to. I'd have to, you know, I'd see a pair of shoes pointing the wrong way in the stall and gently push it open, and then the legislator there who didn't want to be, who was having so much pressure from both sides, he didn't want to. So I had a day like that, and then that evening I went in and I remember this really clearly that day, and I had a class on Thomas Aquinas's theory of existence and essence. So there was real sort of cognitive dissonance between the parts of my life, and I was trying to do them both. I couldn't really integrate them very well. I also was, and even though I say I loved this part of my life and I enjoyed the excitement and it was very visceral and physical, I actually was in really good shape physically because I would have to literally run around to get things done. But even though I was loving it, there was part of me that was really becoming a person I didn't want to be, and I discovered that most when I ran for office. I found myself shading the truth in ways I didn't want to and making excuses for myself, and I was just starting to just kind of not like myself.
Well, wow, that's incredible. I mean, it's just the story of the legislator in the stall. Now I can understand why you were the most feared lobbyist in Maryland.
Right.
That's amazing. You've used, you know, in talking about St. John's and talking about this experience, you've used the term monastery a few times, like a monastery for learning.
Yeah.
And in your own bent towards contemplation. Was this kind of at this point in time mostly kind of intellectual? But, you know, contemplation is a little deeper than that. I'm wondering kind of, was there a spirituality starting to infuse at any point in this?
There was, yeah, there definitely was. I mean, you know, I come out of the 60s, and this stuff was all starting to get mixed together back then, and I was starting to read Eastern things, and I was starting, you know, back in the 70s, I got involved with transcendental meditation. I had friends that were doing that. So I was really, and even the intellectual part when I was at St. John's, I mean, we read a lot of, they were all Western, but we read a lot of religious thinkers, and I started to think about what this all means in a much broader way. And I started meditating, and so I was playing. I didn't have any really systematic integration of all those things, but all those elements were starting to be part of my life back then.
Yeah. And what drew you to Catholic University in terms of the evening courses you were taking?
I had other friends from, there were some people who were connected to St. John's who started teaching at Catholic, and I had some other friends who went there for philosophy. So I think at first I just followed the crowd, but it was interesting to me. I mean, I'm Jewish, and it was interesting to me to be involved in a Catholic university. A lot of my professors were priests or brothers. So I did start reading some Catholic theology and just got a sense of that world.
Right. So I'm fascinated by the way you describe your turn back to MIT, first as a PhD student, and you talked about political science being kind of neither. Kind of right. A compromise route that ended up being kind of neither. It's actually interesting you say that. I find that very apt. I think I kind of agree with that because you're neither being in the political world, nor are you really doing the real contemplation of the life's biggest issues. But curious. So, what did you like? For example, what did you do your thesis on? And then you said by the end of that, you kind of, when you got into the experimental study group, you kind of went full on philosophy. So, just curious, kind of the subjects within both of those disciplines that intrigued you.
Well, I did my thesis on the idea of consent and what kind of a voting system would actually capture what we mean by consent, the consent of the governed, and what kind of voting system would capture that. So when you think about consent, if you really want to think about it full on, you have to think about who we are and what free will means and a lot of deeper issues. But I was reading on those, but I couldn't really incorporate those in my political science thesis. Partially, I married a woman whose life is really centered in spiritual practices and contemplation. So that started also to pull me more inward, although, you know, I married her because that's what I wanted in my life. So so it wasn't accidental. It's hard to trace the I was teaching at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania for 3 years, and I think I was already morphing into a philosopher because although I was a really popular teacher, and when they let me go, there was even a student protest and all that. I think I was not really doing political science anymore as people in the political science department understood it. I was doing a course on Hegel and feminism, and, you know, it was kind of titularly political, but I was really interested in who we are and how politics flows out of who we are. Mm-hmm. Those kind of questions it's hard to engage in the world of political science.
Yeah. So then you got involved with the experimental study group and you know, if you want to kind of elaborate on what that's about, that would be great. But I'm really interested in getting to, you know, how did you get interested in working with prisoners and how did that kind of come about?
So that's let's go to that one. So that's another thing that life has since for a long time has kept throwing me in that direction, but I didn't know it was throwing me in that direction, so I just sort of bounced back. But my very first job out of college, it was just one of those jobs. I had a degree in liberal arts, and what do you do with that? So I just fell into this job at the Federal Bureau of Prisons. That was my first job. I was just a lowly researcher, but one of the things that part of my research, I was researching a federal drug rehabilitation program, but that took me into prisons where I actually got to talk to prisoners. So it was an experience I'd never had before and never imagined I'd have. But after that, I just saw it as a job and an interesting experience, and I didn't. One thing that happened is I went back to Annapolis and I helped form a group called Offenders Aid and Restoration, which is about transition from jail to local jails to society. As part of our training in that, we required everybody who was going to be involved in it to spend a night in jail. And we had an arrangement with, I think it was the Fairfax County, Virginia jail, where they would let us in for a night and they wouldn't tell anybody else that we were what we were there for. We would just be treated like prisoners. So that all happened, but then I just floated away from that. And then in the 80s, again, just this sort of thing floated into my life again, which is I was teaching a course in nonviolence, but at that time it was more about political strategy, a political approach from nonviolence, using nonviolence as a political strategy. And I was also teaching a course in gender relations with a psychologist who had a connection to a local prison. And through that, I just started the practice every semester of taking my class in to meet with the lifers group. Just because you know, I had a bunch of kids who came from, most of them from pretty sheltered backgrounds, were talking about violence. Let's talk to people who actually have had some experience with violence. That brought me back in touch with the prison stuff. But again, I wasn't thinking of it as some theme in my life. It was just another interesting thing to do. When the Willie Horton incident happened and they closed down a lot of the access to the prisons in the late 80s, so there was a period of time when I couldn't get back in. And then in the 2000s, I started... I had a friend who I knew was teaching through the Boston University program, which is the only university right now in Massachusetts that can grant bachelor's degrees in prison. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I'm just curious. That was my main motivation. What's it like to teach philosophy in prison? I got into that, and it's just become the thing I do now. It's it just everybody. I guess when you align with your dharma, it works. So since then, I'm the head of this program, which is we started off, our main thing is we bring the MIT students in and take class with the inmates, but we're expanding to do other things too. We're looking at trying to bring educational technology into prisons and all sorts of things. But I started doing this thing really out of curiosity and just because I wanted to do it. And then I found people were actually throwing money at me to do it. And it's now the thing I do.
Wow. You know, it's one thing to teach courses in prison and philosophy. Well, it's one thing to teach courses in prison. It's another to teach philosophy in prison. And it's yet another thing to co-teach prisoners and MIT students together.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if you could talk about first just the second step of just, well, maybe each step of what your first experience was like as you started teaching prisoners, and I guess you taught prisoners philosophy. So what was that like, and what were your immediate kind of impressions of that?
The prison population is pretty different than the population of kids that get to MIT. An awful lot of the guys I teach came to prison with something like an eighth grade education. Most of these guys, they didn't just get to prison and they were ready for college. I have one guy I'll talk about who told me his story. He got to prison. He had an eighth grade education. He tested at a third grade reading level. He told me he spent his first 10 years in prison getting in trouble and spent most of it in solitary. And then a light just went off in his head that he was going to be here for a very long time, and is this what he wanted his life to be? And he just started getting himself educated and finally got into the BU program. And this guy was really quite brilliant. And not only was he, I'm going to use that term, monk of knowledge again. That's what he sort of turned his life into. He not only did he do the work splendidly, but he was always educating himself. He was reading all the time. It's kind of like, actually, now that I think of it, it's kind of like the way I felt I was when I was in school, that I was, I just could never get enough, even though if it wasn't what I was supposed to be getting. But I meet guys like that. And the other thing is, it's a much broader range of people with both abilities and experience. And college education is really, in a lot of ways, culturally a very middle-class thing, and it's the way we do it. It speaks more to people with a certain kind of background, and most of the guys in prison don't have that background. They haven't been thinking in that way all their lives. Hmm. So your second question is, what's it like to teach philosophy? My incarcerated students love philosophy. because philosophy is just about exploring. I mean, they love learning everything, but they just, and I think, and my philosophy of philosophy is that philosophy only takes place in conversation. So my classes are very discussion oriented, and these people, I've had a lot of experience with these people just loving getting into these deep questions, and they have a lot of time to think about them.
Yeah, I mean, the thought that comes up from, I've seen some of your syllabi, I mean, they're very, very nuanced and sophisticated philosophy. I mean, I think in your philosophy of love course, you have people read Tristan and Isolde and other things. I mean, how, I guess the question I have is how, you know, for a lot of people, philosophy seems like this nice, flowery thing, but it's hard to feel its immediate relevance to your life. And, I mean, especially with such kind of, you know, what's the word, kind of, you know, abstract texts in part. I'm wondering how do you, it's interesting to me that you feel that your incarcerated students are able to find relevance to that enough that they stay engaged.
My experience is they find more relevance in the subjects we're discussing than almost anything. As I said that, I wanted to slightly take it back because I don't want to insult anybody else who's teaching it. But, I mean, I choose subjects that I think everybody cares about. And not only do they care about, I mean, I teach the course in love and I teach the course in nonviolence. I say to my students sometimes that look at our popular culture, look at our movies to see what we care most about. And if you look at movies, almost every movie is about love or vengeance or some combination of the two. And these are the things that we've got to figure out in our lives, what love is and what role it plays in our lives and what anger and justice and vengeance are in our lives and how we go through life dealing with those issues. So to me, I feel like I'm the two courses that are sort of my signature courses, there are the things that are about the most important things in our lives. And philosophy just means thinking about them deeply. And not all the work I use is official philosophy. We read a lot of literature.
Yeah, so these signature courses on nonviolence and on love, did you develop these as you were working with incarcerated persons, or are these kind of topics and courses you'd already developed and then brought to that population?
So the love course I've been teaching for a really long time, and when I left Swarthmore and left political science, that was the first thing I wanted to think about. I actually developed it when I was teaching at Phillips Academy in Andover, which is a really upscale private school. That's the route that course has traveled, from sort of teaching it to the wealthiest, most connected kids in the country to teaching it in prison. So that I've been thinking about for a really long time. The nonviolence course was one I decided. I mean, I taught, as I said, way back in the 80s, I taught a really political nonviolence course. But at this stage in my life, what I really wanted to think about was what the title of my course is, Nonviolence as a Way of Life. How do we take the principles of nonviolence and apply them to everything we do in life, the way we go through life itself? That one I developed because I thought that was a topic I really wanted to teach in prison, and especially in these mixed classes of MIT students and prisoners.
Yeah, and I remember when I first reached out to you about that nonviolence course, I loved the way you described it, which was not, you made it clear that it wasn't nonviolence as a political strategy, but nonviolence on a deeper plane of just, as you said, a way of life, and yeah, with the social and political flowing from that rather than vice versa.
Yeah, and I have to say I've learned a lot from teaching that. I've only taught that once. This was my first year teaching that. But that very first time, I learned a lot from teaching it in prison. One topic we take up in that course is forgiveness. What is forgiveness? It's not so simple when you really think about it. And who has more to say about forgiveness than these guys that I'm teaching in prison? We were struggling with the idea of what forgiveness is, and we were contemplating a quote, French philosopher Jacques Lacan, and he has this one line, which you can only forgive the unforgivable, meaning, sure, we can always say anything. I understand why he did it. He came from a bad background, or we can say, you know, I can live with that. But that's not forgiving. That's excusing, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is something deeper. Forgiveness is when you fully understand the magnitude of the wrong of the act, and still whatever this thing is, forgive. So we're struggling with what that could possibly mean. And one of my guys who's...
familiar in the Brexit camp.
Hello?
Yeah, we're here. So I don't know what happened. Go ahead, please.
Okay. So one of my guys who's in prison for life said, forgiveness isn't about an act. What I did, he said, actually was unforgivable. And I don't expect anybody to forgive me for that act. What forgiveness means for me is that you not reduce me to being only the person that committed that act, and that you remain open to the possibility that I can become somebody that wouldn't do things like that. You remain open to the possibility that I can change. That's what forgiveness means to me. I don't think I would have had that kind of a conversation just at MIT. I was in a room with people who think in a very deep and personal and really consequential way about what things like forgiveness mean. I don't know. I can't remember the question, so I don't know if that
That's so beautiful. I was just thinking, there's so many ways I could go from here that are all fascinating. I'm just thinking, like, how are the MIT students doing in all of this? Like, how, you know, what is their experience, and how, what are some of the stories of transformation they've experienced? And I want to come back to the prisoners, but.
You know, every single, it's kind of an experience that's too big to articulate, because every single one of my students, if you call them right up right now and ask them, every one of them says it was a life-changing experience to do this. But it's hard for anybody to pin down exactly what that is. one thing is we're in the presence of the kind of people we never meet, and the people in prison are the most despised people in society, and you're having a civil, meaningful conversation with them. That's a pretty important experience. So I don't find my MIT students extremely articulate about how it's changed them, but every one of them will say it's one of the most important things they've ever done.
Yeah. Funny how life-changing experiences are like that, kind of hard to articulate. I wonder, going back to the prisoners, I mean, it's obviously, as you describe these topics and these discussions, it must be very deeply moving, I can imagine, for people to have access to you, to have access to these ideas, to have access to these thoughts. What is the impact for them of being with MIT students? Is there, I mean, these are kids that come from a very different background. Just wondering how they react to that.
Yeah, I've had different kinds of reactions. I mean, I think in general, first of all, you know, at the one prison I teach, there's a room that's the college. It's painted. It's the BU, Boston University classroom. It's painted with BU colors. When you step into that room, you're in Boston University. And my incarcerated students often say when they're in class, they're not in prison. They're leading sort of normal lives. In addition, being in contact with the kind of kids that MIT kids are, it just still normalizes their lives. They're not the kind of people they meet every day. At the same time, I've had, I had them all write out a little evaluation of the course and the experience at the end, and often they say they're kind of intimidated because the MIT is it has a kind of mythical kind of effect on people that these people you're bringing in must be the smartest people in the world, and most of my guys and the women even more, I think, in the women's prison, their experience of life isn't of thinking of themselves as the smartest people in the world. One of the experiences they have in these classes is just learning how well they can think, and learning the pleasures of the life of the mind. But they are not people who have thought of themselves all of their lives as being intellectuals or capable of the kinds of things that MIT students are. So part of their experience is that they're intimidated by the MIT students. But I think in the end, they also have the experience that, in some ways I'm as smart as these kids, and in some ways I'm actually even smarter. So I think that's liberating.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, do you think that the presence of the MIT students, what kind of prisoners or what kind of incarcerated people sign up for these courses? Is it kind of a rare person who signs up for a philosophy course, and especially a philosophy course with MIT students? And I'm just wondering kind of like, and how big are these classes?
The classes are bigger than I'd like them to be. I usually bring about 10 MIT students in, and there's usually about 14 incarcerated students. What kind? I only come in contact in all the most of the stuff I do in prison. I only come in contact with the people that are most interested in self-improvement. So these are really motivated people. First of all, it's hard to get into the prison programs. You have to often keep trying. You have to test into it, and like I said, a lot of these guys, most of these guys, don't have even get to prison with high school degrees. So I'm in contact with people that are really motivated, and usually they're guys that have kind of real leadership qualities. They're kind of leaders in the prison. They're the kind of people that try to civilize their life in prison and keep and they're people with real positive outlooks, for as positive as you can get in a prison.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of feedback, have you gotten any feedback from kind of the wardens and the kind of correctional officers and within the prison?
Well, it's a tricky business. I mean, prison's a tough place, and and balancing the needs of the institution and balancing and with what I'm trying to do takes work and time and skill, and we're not even entirely there yet. So for the most part, in theory, all the people I deal with in prison, the administrators are in theory in favor of the kinds of things we're doing, but they have real concerns about, I mean, for instance, there's a tension between, I want there to be a lot of discussion in my class, but there's real concerns in the prison with boundary issues, between the inmates and what could go wrong. And I respect and I have to take very seriously those concerns. So working out the proper balance is still in progress for us, I think.
Yeah, I guess, when I was glancing at your syllabi, they're incredibly sophisticated in terms of the readings and topics and very intellectual. I'm wondering, are there also personal practices that kind of go along with this kind of head-based learning? And I guess the real question for me in all this is, it just is a personal question in my own life, like how does one cultivate nonviolence and love from the head as opposed to from different sets of practices that you might do?
Yes. So I want to make a very strong case for, so if we go way back to Socrates and sort of Plato after him, really made the case that real philosophy only happens in discussion, that philosophy isn't reading books. As soon as you actually, you can find this in Plato, that as soon as you write it down, you've sort of calcified it. The philosophy is a living practice. It only happens between real people, and although there is in the there are universal truths, the universal truths are only discoverable in particular times as they're relevant to those particular times and the particular people that are discussing them. So I really want to make the case that philosophical discussion is a spiritual practice. It's not all head. I mean, as soon as you engage with another person, your emotions and your whole being is involved. You can't engage another person without having feelings about what you're saying, without dealing with the whole of who you are. So as long as you keep it to the level of discussion, I think you're in the realm of spiritual practice.
That's great. I'm curious, there's so many more things we could go on, but I know there's some questions that are coming in, but a couple more I'll go with. I'm just curious, you've done other work in the prisons as well, especially with the debate team. And I'm just curious, with all of this work, the debate work, the teaching, how has this work with the Prison Initiative transformed you? We've talked about the prisoners and the MIT students changing their lives. I wonder what effect it's had on you.
I think the main stage I'm in right now is, you know, in the sort of Zen, first there's the mountain, and then during Zen, the mountain is no longer a mountain, and then after Zen, it's a mountain again. I think I'm in the mountain's not a mountain stage right now. That is, the stage of transformation I'm in right now is this has upset me, not only in the negative sense, but it kind of in the positive sense. It's upset my complacency that I feel very much in process right now. I feel like I'm really experimenting with letting go of a lot of my presuppositions and a lot of the things that I've sort of taken for granted, and I'm just really in a stage of openness right now. I don't even want to jump to the side of kind of lefty compassion, and I think there are also a lot of social injustices that are exemplified in how our prison system works, but I'm also dealing with people that have done some very bad things, and I'm just kind of open to what that means to me. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm struggling with even saying it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struck by your amazing openness and curiosity to all experience and not trying to label it prematurely. That's what's jumping for me.
That's the way I'm feeling. I just feel like I just want to keep taking it in and keep dealing with it and keep reflecting on what's happening, and at some point in the road it's all gonna kind of season and I'll have some big conclusions. But right now, I like being in the stage of upset, of not knowing exactly what I think about a lot of things.
Yeah, when you mentioned that a lot of presuppositions have been upset. Can you say a little more about that? Like, what kind of presuppositions?
Well, I really struggle with a lot with. I've been on sort of both sides of issues of blame and forgiveness, what we do, how we respond to people that have done terrible wrongs. I've had presuppositions on both sides that, that somehow society is that it's somehow a disservice to us if we don't make very strong statements in terms of punishment. For people that have done very terrible things, and on the other hand, it's not random who it is that winds up doing these things. There's a lot of societal factors. So I've been upset in both. I'm just struggling with that a lot. I mean, one of the things is I deal with some of the people I know in prison have done some very terrible things, and not even just randomly. You know, they've in an organized way, they've been involved in terrible things. And yet I find some of these people I actually like and respect a lot. So I'm just trying to deal with those two sides without artificially coming down on one of them or the other.
It's fascinating. I just wanted to remind our callers that we're going to transition into Q&A in the next couple of minutes. So if you've got a question and you dialed in, you can press *6 to get in the queue. And if you are listening remotely or online, you can submit a question at ask@servicespace.com or submit a question on the web form. And we've had a lot of questions come in. But Preetha, I'll let you ask your final question before I transition to the many questions that have been rolling.
Great. And my final question is kind of a big one. So we can kind of you can take this in whatever way you want to take and go with it in any direction. But so much of what you just said in your last response about, you know, your openness, you're taking it all in. You know, I come back to the way you described your experience in Annapolis about, you know, and your experiences in politics and policy, about the ways in which, you know, your contemplative side was not fully fueled. And I'm wondering kind of, so one way to ask this question, let me ask it a couple ways, and you can decide how you want to answer it. But one way is just, you know, your current views about engaging with politics, policy as a model of social change, kind of how, what you think are ways of engaging in more systemic ways of change. Another way, as you were talking about your, you know, your struggles with dealing with some of the incarcerated people, that you like them as people, but obviously they've done terrible things. And it had shadows to me of how you describe some of the legislators that you dealt with in Annapolis and the way in which you said sometimes the legislators were in some ways the least free people.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just, I don't know, so a lot was coming up for me, you know, Bo Lovelock thing about how we're all doing time.
Yeah.
So anyway, so a lot of different stuff. So you can answer whatever you feel like answering, but I'm curious about your views about systemic social change and kind of now as you're struggling more with this integration of the deep philosophy with active activity in the world, kind of what your thoughts are now about the best ways of, you know, or ways that resonate with you of impacting our systems.
I had an interesting conversation just about a week ago with a guy inside. He quoted to me a line from the Black Panther, Huey Newton. And the line was, "Doing good is a hustle." And I think back in my political days, I think politics, as it's normally practiced and as I practice, is really just an art of manipulation. I was proud of my abilities to manipulate situations to bring the most good out of them, and that doesn't satisfy me anymore. I don't blame him for thinking of doing good as a hustle, but I don't want it to be a hustle for me. I want to take a longer view and have faith that if I pursue what I pursue with just pretty close, as close as I can get to complete honesty, with compassion for everybody, the correctional officers, with understanding, with trying to understand everybody's point of view, with not demonizing anybody. And you have to work in a system like this to not demonize anybody. It comes pretty naturally. I feel like that's the only way I want to do politics, and I guess it's just an act of faith that kind of political engagement is, in the long run at least, going to be more effective than manipulation, which clearly in my experience, manipulation it gets effects faster and gets really concrete effects. I think that's how I would sum it up for me. And for me right now, this is my spiritual practice, and that means it's not just about the immediate effects that that result. It's about living my life as the person I actually really want to be.
Wow. So fascinating, Lee. Thank you so much for sharing it. I've been on the edge of my seat through Preetha's fantastic question. So Preetha, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
You know, on that last answer, I was really reflecting on this notion of how there are so many activists who start from the other end, right? They start from a place of feeling like they're being fully compassionate, fully transparent, honest, and as a result of being frustrated by their inability to achieve concrete action, they would love to have the skills that you have in actually manipulating the system to get a result in a reasonable time frame. And yet you've gone in completely the opposite direction. And I'm just curious about whether you can reflect on the notion of the grass is always greener on the other side and what that means in the inside your deepening spiritual practice, both philosophy and just engagement at the intersection of like what's deeply true inside, kind of scaling to the outside world.
Well, as to the grass is always greener, my philosophical orientation is dialectical. That my primary assumption is that on both sides of any important question, there's some truth. I don't even know if where I'm at right now is right. When I answered that guy about the, you know, about doing good as a hustle, somebody else said, "Well, the fact that you don't think of it that way is a product of white privilege, that you don't have to think of it that way." And you know, I'm willing to contemplate that too. I'm willing to go back and forth between the two different sides. I guess part of it for me, though, the reason I'm on this side right now is I was involved in all the ferment of the 60s, and I was very political back then, and things were accomplished, and the world's a better place for some of the things, but look at the backlash we're getting. Somehow or other, we didn't get through in the way we needed to an awful lot of people. I think if you're going to, the foundational thing that has to be changed is the culture that underlies our politics. And you can't do that from a manipulative standpoint. You can change the surface things, but you can't change the foundation manipulatively. And that's what engages me now. I don't even know if that answered your question, but it answered some question.
It did. It was a very powerful answer, and I really appreciate that lens. I wanted to remind the folks who have dialed in live that they can press *6 to answer a question, but we have had a bunch come in online. We've got Nancy Miller from Arlington, Virginia, who asks, how did the dynamics of race and poverty enter your work? Many of the inmates and clients I work with are people of color. Many are traumatized for a variety of reasons, have poor educational backgrounds, and issues with addiction. So how does race and poverty figure into your work?
Well, by the time that people get to the classes that I'm teaching, they have to have dealt with a lot of those debilitating issues. Prison is distinctly not proportional in its racial composition to society. We all know that. I deal with what's, and this is just what I have to offer. We all can just offer what we have to offer. There are classes in prison that deal directly with race. There are sociology classes and all sorts of classes like that. But I deal with common humanity. I deal with the ways in which we're all the same. And again, that's just what I have to offer. And it doesn't mean it's a better way of dealing with it. But I think that's my primary. I'm certainly open to all those I actually have an interesting story about that, which is, an interesting story that speaks to that maybe you can't always abstract from your circumstances, even in the most abstract philosophical conversations. There's a famous ethical thought experiment that's presented in every ethics class everywhere, which is called the trolley problem, which is you're walking down a track, you see that there's one person working on one track and two people working on another track. You get to a place where the tracks join, you see a train that's out of control. There's a switch there. You can tell that if you don't pull the switch, the train's going to go down the track and kill the person on one track. And the two people on the one track, and if you pull it, they'll go the other track and just kill the one person. And it's supposed to ask questions about our about utilitarianism, whether or not whether you're responsible to make sure that the least amount of harm occurs, and whether acting is a morally equivalent to not acting. So when I teach that at MIT or Harvard or any place else like that, we deal with it on that really abstract level. And when I taught that in prison, not one but a couple of the African-American guys said, their response to it was, as a man of color, I just run. Because if I pull the switch, I'm going to jail. If I don't pull the switch, I'm going to jail. I just get out of there. So, even when you're trying to keep it on a really abstract level, the concrete circumstances of our lives do come in.
Sure, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Maybe just to hover on the center of Nancy's question, she may have been asking about sort of the effects of trauma on the students, on the class, and kind of trying to probe into whether they may have dealt with those effects already through other things offered in prison, or are they just, because it's so selective, have they somehow found a way to transcend that personally? What's your experience of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. A concrete answer is, so I've had people say to me, I teach philosophy of love. It makes us think about the nature of love. It seems like a lovely thing to think about, but when I teach it in the women's prison especially, I'm dealing with a population of people that have been, for the most part, traumatized by love. Love, in quotes, has been an extremely hurtful thing in their lives, and in many, many, many cases, it has a lot to do with why they're there in prison. So I was asked to consider whether or not am I really equipped to deal with the traumas that come up when I discuss those questions with these women, even though all of them have done all sorts of counseling and things like that. And sometimes when I get papers from them about these very erudite books that they're reading, they've put their own stories in them, and their histories of love, and the stories are some of them are really horrible. So I don't know. I do have to be aware of that. I can't just pretend that that the life of the mind is detached from the rest of our lives. To think seriously about love when you come from a background of experiences that masqueraded as love and were extremely destructive, it's not a neutral thing.
Sure, absolutely. We've got another question from Ian Schiffer from Madrid, Spain. He says, thanks, Lee, for all of your work. How do you feel that spirituality can start and blossom within repressive systems? Keeping in mind the radical education that often takes place inside prisons and hollow contemporary has worked in critical pedagogy, how do you recognize the lived expertise of people who are incarcerated within your classes, noting the gap many of these students face, especially with outside students also included in your classes who are often affirmed in their meritocratic achievements? Wow, that's a heavy question.
Yeah, I do have to deal with all those issues. And I think, as I said earlier, a lot of the incarcerated students report being intimidated by the MIT students. I think the wisdom that comes from experience just cannot be in itself repressed in a classroom like this. I mean, one thing we haven't mentioned is that, I mean, one of the things that I think is so important to the MIT students is not only are they meeting, they're having discussions about central life issues with people from a very different background, but also you spend your whole 4 years in college talking only to professors who are hierarchically superior to you and equals who are all exactly your own age and probably come from a pretty similar background to you. When they take class in prison, they're in class with men in their 60s. They're in class with people that come from really wildly different circumstances from them. And it becomes really, I think one of the things that the incarcerated students learn is how smart they really are and how the breadth of their experience gives them a kind of wisdom that these brilliant young whippersnappers don't have. And I think the MIT students learn that too. I think I referred before to our discussion of forgiveness. Well, the MIT students, they sat in that discussion as the learners and the incarcerated guys were the teachers in that class. Although there was mutual learning going on, but that was the major role. I actually think there's a lot of dignity in the life of the mind itself, and I think they experience themselves as being they get in touch with their own intelligence in a way that they've never done before in their lives. It's a big question. I can't answer the whole question.
Yeah, it is quite a big question. I'm curious, you kept mentioning that you obviously encounter people who have done some pretty horrible things. In your experience, have you ever encountered a person that you regard as evil? And I guess maybe what I mean by that is, we hear about how the prevalence of kind of psychopathy or maybe sociopathy or both is about 1% in the general population, and it's 4% in prisons and in the corporate boardrooms, ironically, as well. But, the people who have made it into your classes and passed all the hurdles have obviously either worked through or been very successful at kind of manipulating a system to be able to have access. And so in my mind, the thought was, if there ever was someone who is genuinely and truly evil, they would have managed to be able to work their way into the best part of the prison system. And it sounds like you're doing something that's pretty transformative, but certainly helpful. But what's been your reflection on evil?
That gets to the real root of some things. So for me, I think the main dividing line is how genuine somebody is and how much I feel like they're being entirely real with me. There are guys that have done terrible things, but I feel a realness about them, and I'm sure of it, and they're really struggling with these things. And then there are other people. The people that strike, that come closest to what you're calling evil, are the people for whom they can't ever get out of their manipulative mind. It always feels like manipulation. And some of those people are the most charming people in my class. In some ways, some of the more charming guys wind up giving me the creeps more than the people that are just plain. And there's some, well, there was one of our class discussions, one of the guys who had taken a life said to this was actually in the discussion of forgiveness as well. He said to one of the students, "Do you think I'm evil?" And she, taken aback, I think, surprised, but she just said, "Well, yes, I kind of do." And this guy said, "Thank you. Thank you for being so honest." Because almost nobody will say things. People, I know how many people are thinking that, but almost nobody will say that to me. And now we can have a real conversation. But of course, by doing that, to me, he demonstrated that whatever it is that's gone wrong in his life, I wouldn't call it evil. But yeah, the hardest people are the people that I feel there's still, it all comes from a spirit of manipulation, that reality is a game to be manipulated. And some of the people that I have the most trouble with, and I struggle the most with being kind and compassionate, I think some of the sexual offenses are the ones that are most challenging.
Yeah, that's quite understandable. We have Nancy Miller again from Arlington says, "How do you engage the inmates? How do you get them to talk and reveal aspects of themselves in an open and honest way? Same for the MIT students." And then she also wants to get a copy of your Love and Nonviolence and Forgiveness courses because she teaches mindfulness and meditation in jails and detox centers in the Metro DC area, and the topics that you teach come frequently in her discussion.
So for the last, she just email me at lperlman@mit.edu. And I actually find incarcerated students, and there is some gender disparity here between the way men react and women in prison, but I find them easier to engage in a lot of ways than MIT students. They're much more comfortable with discussion. They're much more comfortable with being wrong, so they're more willing to speak up. They kind of argue and fight with each other in class in a very free way, and they're willing to back off when they're wrong. I find MIT students tend to have a much more perfectionist kind of constraint on their speaking, and so they're very careful. They don't want to say anything that doesn't seem brilliant. So I find the incarcerated students quite easy to engage. There is some difference between the men and women students on a kind of broad average, which is the women, incarcerated women students, I think, tend to be a little less self-confident for sort of obvious reasons, given their backgrounds, and so they don't speak up as easily. But even there, I think it doesn't take long. I don't have any specific method. It's just I try to approach it with an air that anything's welcome here, and it's my job to rein it in if it's getting too tangential.
Sure. I had another question about sort of dials back into this topic, the syllabus around nonviolence. I'm just curious to understand what your evolving understanding of that has been, particularly given that my exposure to the term is from the Sanskrit for ahimsa, and mm-hmm. nonviolence is actually a very poor translation of that because sort of like a double negative. But ahimsa is really a completely different way of being, which is just so overwhelmingly positive that there is no space for the negative. So just curious what your experience of that has been going from kind of the political strategy to the way of being to, you know, what you're actually teaching and able to teach in class?
I think that for me, my understanding of Gandhi's thought is that the central concept in Gandhi's thought was not ahimsa, but his central concept was the term that he coined, satyagraha, which means it's usually translated as firmness in the truth. From satya, meaning truth, which comes from sat, which means being. And so it's a conception of truth in which, in a certain way, we live in the world as it is, as it truly is, without trying to fabricate it or romanticize it or pretend it's something other than what it is. And that's, in a way, the goal. Ahimsa is completely a valuable goal all in and of itself, but it's also a goal that serves satyagraha. That is, when you don't manipulate a situation or introduce violence to try to wrench it out of its natural path, then you'll see the world as it is. To me, that's come to be this really, I think, the central, and that's the central concept, and it's how I integrate philosophy with action, I think, which is that for me, it's all a search for truth, for understanding who I truly am, who we truly are together, what the situation is we find ourselves in, without trying to manipulate it, which requires an acceptance sometimes and a willingness to not impose on the situation what you want it to be, but just see it as it is. Yeah, I think that's, for me, the central concept right now of nonviolence.
That blends so perfectly with my next question, which is really around understanding what you think the role of mindfulness or meditation has been in prison, particularly given your experience with transcendental meditation.
Well, I've had a lot of experiences with meditation since. I've gone on long meditation retreats. I've spent 14 hours meditating in a kind of a cave, and I think one of the to see the world as it truly is, you have to come to grips with your ability to be with yourself as yourself, and that's one of the things that meditation does for me. When I'm not in a meditative frame of mind, when I drift far away from that, then all my restless random desires take over, and they impose on the world my restlessness and what I need it to be, and I can't just experience it. So for me, it's very important. I can't really introduce, Preeta asked me earlier about this, I can't really introduce those elements into my courses for institutional reasons, that it's important that my courses be seen as kind of traditionally academic. I probably have more freedom to do that outside of the prison than I do inside. But one thing is that men in prison, men and women in prison, become, they all tend to, it's very, very common to turn to spirituality as a central point of meaning in your life. So I can, when I teach that course on the soul, one of the things I try to look at conceptions of the soul across all the religious traditions, but look at it philosophically. But it's really easy to do in prison, because almost all the men or women in my class, incarcerated ones, are engaged in spirituality. They're all either practicing Muslims or Buddhists or Christians, and so we have real experience, although we can't do the experiences in the class, we have real experiences to draw on.
Fascinating. Lee, it's my privilege as the host to ask you one final question, which is, how can we as the larger service-based community support your work?
The first thing I'd say is become aware of the criminal justice system in this country. The criminal justice system is in some respects kind of our crazy relative in the attic. We don't want to look at it. We don't want to know what's going on there. And it's also one of the most difficult things to raise in the political environment because we're dealing again with the people that we've all decided are the, and for some good reasons, are the most despised people in our society that deserve the least from us. So the main way, the main kind of support I ask is that people just, I won't tell you what conclusions to come to, but just become aware of what we do with the people that we lock up in the society, and become aware of also what that system does to the people that have to administer it. Become aware of it and decide for yourself whether this is what you want. And if it's not, then become involved in trying to make it different.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Lee. We like to end our call with a collective minute of silence, and we're actually completely at the end time, so we're going to go a couple minutes over for this. But we invite everyone to hold a collective minute of silence, and this time in gratitude for your time and your work and all of the causes and conditions that have allowed us to benefit from your journey through this conversation. And then at the end of the call, we're going to unmute folks so that those who've dialed in have the opportunity to actually express their gratitude with a collective thank you. So first we'll just do that 1 minute of silence.
Yeah, and Raul, if I could just add, sorry, this is Preeta. Lee, as you were speaking and answering questions, so much gratitude has kind of flowed in through the web in both the pre-call reflections and in various statements. Just incredible gratitude around the world for all of the work you do.
Oh, that's heartwarming. Thank you.
Thank you. I am actually going to take everyone off of mute now, and on the count of we'll have the opportunity to just collectively say thank you, Lee. So here we go. We're going to try this. One, two, three. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
Blessed be.
Thank you for your work. Thank you for bringing this to our day.
Well, thank you all for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. It was really talking about it deepens the work for me. Thank you.
Beautiful. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.